Top stories. At least 3 people are killed and 15 others wounded in yet another explosion targeting a mosque in Afghanistan, this time in the eastern province of Nangarhar. The UK's top court is hearing a complaint that senior British officers were involved in covering up the killings of Afghan civilians during the war in Afghanistan. Iran says the removal of U.S. sanctions against Tehran is the main purpose of its upcoming talks with the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. Welcome to the program. At least 3 people have been killed in a blast in Afghanistan's eastern province of Nangarhar. Medical sources say 15 others have been injured. A Taliban official said the blast targeted a Sunni mosque in Spinqar district. While people were holding Friday prayers, there has been no immediate claim of responsibility. The explosion is the latest in a series of attacks carried out against mosques in Afghanistan since the Taliban's return to power in mid-August. More than 120 people were killed in 2 blasts in 2 Shia mosques in October. Daesh claimed responsibility for those attacks. Senior British military officers were aware of a series of killings of Afghan men by British troops during the war in Afghanistan about a decade ago. The officers failed to properly investigate those killings that, in some cases, involved unarmed Afghans. That's what the High Court has heard. A hearing began on Tuesday, lasting for 4 days. The claim is being made on behalf of Saifullah Yar, an Afghan man whose 4 male relatives were killed in a British Special Forces night raid in February 2011. The soldiers said they had acted in self-defense, accusing the men of carrying weapons. Saifullah's family denies that. His lawyers have now brought the case, saying there had been allegations of, quote, patterns of unlawful killings and a cover-up. Lawyers have asked for more documents relating to executions of, quote, fighting-age males by British troops. The Defense Ministry says it has already released enough documents. Back in 2014, the Ministry launched a probe into those executions, examining 11 incidents, but the probe ended in 2019 without any prosecution. Iran's lead negotiator in the upcoming P4+1 talks in Vienna has met with officials from the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal. Mr. Ali Bagheri Kani has described the meetings as positive, while reiterating Tehran's position that the talks will aim at the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions. Amina Taylor is in London.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bagheri Kani, visited London for high-level talks ahead of upcoming negotiations in the Austrian capital that have stalled since June of 2021. It was the first official visit of a high-ranking Iranian diplomat to the UK Foreign Office in some time.
I met with a number of UK Foreign Ministry officials today. We had comprehensive discussions on bilateral relations, regional issues, and also future negotiations.
The long and complicated history between Tehran and London means there are always matters up for discussion. But topping the agenda this time around are the sanctions removal talks due at the end of the month. The Islamic Republic has underlined its position as not simply a return to the negotiating table, rehashing previously decided matters.
The main purpose of these talks from the Islamic Republic of Iran's standpoint is to lift the illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation by the U.S. government in blatant violation of the JCPOA and the blatant violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231.
Having been in Europe for the better part of a week, relaying the Iranian perspective was paramount.
I've had good conversations with the political officials of France, Germany, and the UK in the past 3 days. At the same time as being straightforward and serious, those conversations were clear and progressive. I shared our perspective on the necessary framework for the upcoming talks in an unequivocal and very transparent manner.
Iran has already stated its willingness to deliver a good agreement, but that might hinge on the willingness of the remaining parties to honor the existing terms and walk back the failed maximum pressure campaign initiated by Washington after their unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. More will be clear when all the parties meet on November the 29th. Amina Taylor, London.
Political commentator Jason Androa believes all U.S. efforts at this point is dedicated to continuing its maximum pressure campaign on Iran rather than returning to the nuclear deal.
I think that the United States will only actually return to the JCPOA once it can cause further harm to Iran. Basically, what is in my opinion is that the current unjust sanctions that were placed by the previous U.S. administration are not going to be removed. Essentially, the U.S. is going to leave these sanctions in place and maybe even demand more. I mean, if the U.S. simply wanted to return honest and fairly, it really wouldn't have required seven rounds of talk. All they could do is simply return to the previous agreement with the previously agreed to levels of sanctions or no sanctions, etc. But it's very clear that the U.S. has not done that. So I think that this sends a definite message that the U.S. is not willing to act honorably or even in a most basic, decent manner. I think that the United States is going to continue to try to pressure Iran into accepting new sanctions or a new set of sanctions, etc. So I don't see the U.S. is going back to the regular deal. I think all U.S. effort at this point is dedicated towards trying to place, even more of this maximum pressure campaign on Iran, and it's not going to return to the original agreement.
The Syrian army has intercepted a U.S. military convoy in the northeastern province of Hasaka. According to local sources, the army confronted the U.S. convoy at a checkpoint near the city of Qamishli. The convoy, made up of five vehicles, was attempting to enter the city, but it was forced to turn back. Last month, local residents prevented another American military convoy from crossing through their village near Qamishli. Such incidents have repeatedly happened since the U.S. stationed its forces in northeast Syria in 2015. At the time, the U.S. said the deployment aimed to back Kurdish forces fighting the Daesh terror group, but Damascus has repeatedly called for an end to the U.S. presence, accusing Washington of stealing Syrian oil. Let's try to understand more on that story through the help of our man, Muhammad Ali, who is standing by for us and comes to you live via Skype out of Damascus. Muhammad Ali, tell us what we've been finding out on this.
Yes, what we know is that there was a U.S. military convoy that tried to enter from the direction of the southwest there. However, there was a Syrian army checkpoint over there and blocked that military convoy made up of five vehicles from entering the city and forced it to return back from where it came. This is not the first time only the Syrian army the movement of military vehicles for the United States in that part of Syria and Al-Hasakeh governorate and the countryside of Al-Hasakeh. Locals and residents of towns and villages over there also repeatedly blocked the movement of such vehicles, which reflects the rejection of the Syrian people, of course, the presence, the illegal presence of the United States and its occupation of areas in the country, not just areas, but also the United States illegally established military bases, also occupied oil fields, trying over there and keep it in a state of instability, also giving all of the oil resources in that area, which is the richest area in Syria and the northeast of such resources, giving all of them to the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, which of course blocks such oil resources from reaching the west of the Syrians in the major part of the country. Of course, the United States also on many occasions loots the Syrian oil and transports it all the way back to Iraq from illegal border crossings. So what the United States is clearly has been doing in the past years is dividing the country, illegally occupying it, and also hindering any kind of political solution due to its occupation of parts of Syria, and giving all of those resources to the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces. It even moves over there under the protection sometimes of trucks for the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces. At the end of the day, the people over there is rejecting such occupation, and such kind of rejection also proves that there is no support by the locals and residents there to the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, which is also occupying, with the help of the United States, parts of that country.
Many, many thanks. It's Mohammed Ali, our correspondent in Damascus, updating us on the situation there. Have a good day, Mohammed. Palestinian prisoner Mehdad al-Ghawasmi ends his nearly 4 months of hunger strike after the Israeli regime decided to release him.
Mehdad's demand was quite normal, as he refused to eat and drink, which is everyone's right. And it is his absolute right to enjoy freedom. When his right to freedom was violated and he went on hunger strike, he was quite sure about what he was doing, and he knew that he was right. But unfortunately, we are living under tyranny and oppression, and he was arrested just because a local officer issued an order for his arrest without any legal justification. These people are truly free people, and they should be looked up to.
Palestinian Prisoners Information Office said the regime has agreed to free Ghawasmi in February of next year. It said the agreement was reached after long negotiations between a group of Hamas prisoners and the Israeli prison service. Ghawasmi was a hunger strike for 113 days before being taken to the ICU due to his deteriorating conditions. Hamas has hailed his resistance, saying the decision to release him shows Israel's failure to discourage Palestinians from fighting for freedom. Correspondent Ashraf Shannon says Palestinians believe the great victory achieved by Mehdad al-Ghawasmi against his Israeli captors is an achievement for all Palestinian nation.
Mehdad al-Ghawasmi ended his nearly 4 months hunger strike, to be exact, 113 days, fighting the Israeli regime, fighting the so-called Israel prison service, which is in charge of 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers, holding around 5,000 Palestinian prisoners, including women and children. Mehdad al-Ghawasmi, according to Hamas, has scored a huge victory against his captors. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem said yesterday that al-Ghawasmi's victory is a victory for all Palestinians and victory for all prisoners. The issue of Palestinian prisoners is highly emotive, Arash, for Palestinians, because they view them as political prisoners and as heroes of resistance against the Israeli occupation. Since 1967 alone, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians. And also, we have to mention that more than 50,000 of them were placed under the so-called administrative detention. And this is what Mehdad al-Ghawasmi was fighting in, during his hunger strike. He was fighting this illegal and inhumane policy.
The United Arab Emirates and Bahrain are taking part in a joint military drill with Israel and the U.S. a year after they normalized ties with Tel Aviv. The drill is taking place in the Red Sea. It began on Wednesday, running for 5 days. That's according to the U.S. Navy. It says the exercises include boarding, search, and seizure training. An Israeli naval officer says the drill could help counter what he calls Iran's power projection in the region. The exercises are the first publicly announced military cooperation between the four sides since Bahrain and the UAE established diplomatic ties with Israel last September. Manama and Abu Dhabi did so under U.S. brokered deals, which Palestinians see as a stab in their back. I spoke to political commentator Mr. Einar Tangen earlier, who told me the U.S. tries to form alliances with local players various parts of the world where it faces challenges to its hegemonic ambitions from different sources such as Iran and China.
Well, I don't think it's any coincidence that the U.S. is forming alliances in all areas where they think they have confrontation. They're now in basically a three-front situation. They have the Quad in trying to India, Australia, etc., Japan, trying to hem in the China. in the east. Obviously, Iran is the concern of the U.S., and they're trying to get these navies together and put them into some sort of war footing. And then you have NATO and Russia. So at this juncture, the U.S. is extending itself. It seems to want to bring in local players. But, you know, let us be realistic. None of these are massive seagoing powers. It's hard to see how anything would be coordinated. It would still fall on the U.S. Navy to do anything if there was, in fact, any kind of armed conflict. It's certainly the U.S. is pursuing the same strategy, where regardless whether it's China, Iran, or Russia, they feel that they need to, quote, get a gang of other countries together who they can say, you know, are siding with them in their particular imposition of values or push for American hegemony.
Russia says it will act to defend its security if there is any threatening action by its opponents along its borders after the country detected 6 NATO flights over Black Sea in the last 24 hours. Russian government spokesman Dmitry Peskov described as provocative the increase in the activities of NATO in the Black Sea and presence of Western spy planes. Peskov dismissed a Western media report on the U.S. concerns about Russia's possible attack on Ukraine. He said Russia has posed no threat to any country. Separately, the Russian Defense Ministry criticized the U.S. military activity in the Black Sea, saying it threatens regional and strategic stability.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The 8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Since the Cold War, America has thought itself invincible, but it could not stop Iran from seizing an oil tanker in recent days. Whether it couldn't or didn't depends on who you're hearing it from, as well as both sides' capabilities and policy. But hard facts also speak for themselves and appear to have surfaced quite late in Western media. So Iranian forces seized an oil tanker. Can sound hostile, but Iran says all it was doing was taking back what was its own property to begin with. Its action also served as a statement of sovereignty in our strategic southern waters of the Oman Sea. To hear what actually happened, stay with me, Leila Faramayzi, on Iran Today. Looking at the incident in light of rumors, it may sound confusing. A Vietnamese flagged ship captured by Iran with America showing concern. What reads with what? Well, there's plenty of footage speaking for itself, if only folks would have asked. Here's what happened. American forces confiscated a tanker that was carrying a cargo of Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman, and they transferred its consignment of crude oil to another vessel, which they started guiding to an unknown location. Well, the U.S. has sanctioned Iran's oil and economy in general, but the sanctions are illegal by a couple of interpretations of international law. And to Iran, America's act was no more than an act of piracy. Naturally, Iranian forces wasted no time in recovering the oil. Mr. Ghaffari is editor-in-chief at a well-known daily. We visited to hear his well-studied media man's view of what America's timing and relaying of the incident meant.
The important point is that sometimes there is ambiguity about the nationality of the tanker, and questions are raised about whether it was an American or Vietnamese vessel. We usually see that some nations use their tankers under other nations' flags, and sometimes the crew members aren't even the nationals of that country. The United States was controlling the ship. It took Iranian oil, transported it to the tanker at sea, and was carrying it towards its own waters. There's no doubt about this, but it has done so under a new appearance and form.
Mr. Ojorlu is an analyst whom we got to have a chat with at the Tehran Strategic Studies Institute. He gave us his take on the oil tanker situation.
Given the general standoff between Iran and America, what's your take on the recent oil tanker situation that occurred close to students' day in Iran?
This stick-and-carrot policy is a traditional approach the United States has adopted toward the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we have seen many times that the United States, especially under the recent administrations of President Obama, Trump, and then Biden, has repeatedly stated that they are willing to pursue diplomacy on an international stage. They call for engaging in diplomacy, but in practice, we see they resort to military, security, and political threats to put pressure on the Islamic Republic. This raises a question for the Islamic Republic about whether the U.S. is honest in its words and actions.
Here's how this country's action or reaction went. Iran's forces landed their helicopters on the second vessel's deck and navigated it toward Iranian waters with the oil. The IRGC Navy's drone units, speedboats, and other vessels, meanwhile, assisted the operation. Oil Minister Javad Orji summed it up in explaining America's intentions. Iran's enemies had resorted to the act of piracy after realizing that the Islamic Republic was determined to export its fuel despite the United States sanctions targeting the country, he said. As for whether and how American forces ever present in our regional waters took action or not in response to Iran's reaction, why would the U.S. cause yet another standoff with Iran in snatching its oil just before Students' Day in this country and before the JCPOA revival Vienna talks the U.S. is almost threatening Iran into? The USS Sullivan's DDG-68 and USS Michael Murphy DDG-112, two American destroyers, approached the second tanker. This was to prevent its recapture, but they were warned away by the IRGC Navy. After the heli-borne operation, U.S. forces started pursuing the second vessel with several helicopters and warships, but they stopped short of capturing it, IRGC Public Relations reported. U.S. forces then dispatched more warships to block the vessel that was carrying the stolen crude, but again they stopped short and aborted the operation and area.
The defense and security power of the Islamic Republic of Iran has increased. The Islamic Republic isn't simply making claims. Almost all international and regional observers acknowledge that. Nations boost their military and security potentials to increase deterrence against impending threats. The same seems to have happened in this incident as well. The Islamic Republic has faced the threat and responded to it in the most appropriate way. To that end, it has been willing to conduct a military maneuver. That's because Iran has come to the conclusion that if it does not respond to the U.S.'s excessive demands, the vital interests of the Iranian people will be jeopardized.
If the U.S. expected Iran to sit back and watch, that's exactly what happened to its own forces while Iran did take action. Mr. Asafari is an MP, moderate in some ways. But like most anyone here, he sees no two ways when it comes to oil snatching and a show of force and retaliation.
Our motto is that if there can't be any oil trade in Iranian waters, this can't be applicable solely to Iran. We won't allow them to sell oil in the region if we can't do the same. our tanker was navigating on its route before it was confronted by a U.S. warship. But the presence of the IRGC's powerful navy made them give up the tanker so we could return to our territorial waters. We did not let them prevent us from selling our oil.
So far, U.S. invincibility seems like no more than a myth. The U.S. still maintains a presence, even throws about its weight on the world stage. It is weighty, but it's no longer the only big boy on the block. Iran is an upcoming power, or at least unafraid or reluctant to bow to imperialism and hegemony.
Yes, I believe that the hegemony of arrogance was broken in the aftermath of February 1979. Until then, no one dared to chant slogans against the United States and protest against Washington. But now, you see when the American president visits Iraq, an Iraqi journalist greets him with a shoe. Or when the president of the United States goes to an Asian, African, or even a European country, people greet him with rotten tomatoes. These behaviors did not exist before the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
And there are two ready-made world powers already out there. That's Russia and China. America may still be the front-runner in military might and technology, but it's only a matter of time. Iran has demonstrated how invincibility is a myth in more than one instance, portraying the U.S. as a menace and sponsor of terror more than anything. In January 2020, Nabil Rauk, the deputy head of Hezbollah's executive council, said of Iran's precision missile strikes at U.S. military bases in Iraq in retaliation for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, IRGC, shattered Washington's invincibility myth. And that just marks the start of a possible response. It sent out a message that American targets in West Asia are within reach wherever they are. With the given oil tanker incident, one might wonder, how far could the U.S. have gone in retaliation and why?
If the Americans wanted to react, they would have done so in the 40 years that have elapsed since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. They have been threatening us militarily, politically, and economically for 40 years. They do not dare to take military action, because today the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet is within range of our Zelzal missiles and long-range surface-to-sea and anti-ship missiles.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
What do authorities in Iran say of the U.S. causing an oil incident with this country? And what do the people of the world think about an American presence in all matters global? Let's see through the lens of other media outlets. For a quick media review, I give you Sarah.
Hello and welcome to the news part of the program with me, Sarah Adema. Today we will be looking at some media reviews regarding Iran-U.S. confrontation in the Oman Sea. Our first review here is from Tasnim News Agency. President Raisi says, Iranian nation victorious in face of U.S. hostilities. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi referred to decades of U.S. hostile acts against the country and said that since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the Iranian nation has been the one emerging victorious in the face of these animosities. The U.S. enmity with the Iranian nation goes back not to four, but to seven decades ago, the president said in a gathering of the people of Semnan, a city 180 kilometers east of Tehran, held to commemorate the National Day of the Fight Against Global Arrogance. Raisi said in the first three decades, the Americans managed to plunder the Iranian people's assets with coup and support from puppet rulers. However, over the past 43 years after the victory of the revolution, the victor in this battle against the endless enmities of the Americans has been the Iranian nation. He also hailed a recent IRGC Navy confrontation with the U.S. forces in the Sea of Oman and described the Americans' act of piracy as abominable. Let's check out another review from Meh News Agency. Iranian general warns enemies not to test power of IRGC and army. Major General Ghulam Ali Rashid made the remarks among the army commanders in the area of the Zulfaqar 1400 military exercise. Referring to the capabilities and combat readiness of the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran, General Rashid said, "The Iranian army and armed forces are always ready for a strategic, operational, and tactical confrontation with the aim of maintaining the security, stability, and territorial integrity of Iran against the coalition of enemies, specifically the U.S. Zionist coalition." He also stressed, "Iran armed forces, including IRGC or the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and army forces, will respond decisively to any threats by any arrogant and aggressor power at any level and from the origin of any country." Our last review from Truthout reads, "People worldwide name U.S. as a major threat to world peace. Here is why. How is it that people across the globe have come to agree that the United States is now one of the primary threats to world peace and democracy? Having leveled two Japanese cities with atomic bombs and established itself as the world's top superpower following the collapse of the international order in the aftermath of World War II, the U.S. quickly became intoxicated by its newfound military superiority. The U.S. soon went on to introduce a doctrine that positioned itself as the world's police, dropped more bombs in the Korean and Vietnamese wars than there had been dropped in the whole course of World War II, and orchestrated military coup against democratically elected governments throughout Latin America. It ended up, in turn, supporting brutal dictatorship and establishing more foreign military bases than any other nation or empire in history all over the globe. In the 20th century, labeling various activities terrorism was one way of rationalizing the use of force. The U.S. did this especially with its allies in response to anti-colonial liberation movements. So the South African apartheid regime called anti-apartheid resistance terrorism, and the Israeli regime did and continues to do the same to Palestinian resistance, however non-violent. The U.S. has armed and defended these states, embracing and promoting the rhetoric of war against terrorism. That's it for me in today's edition, and now, back to you, Leila.
About the American presence and the given October incident, the prominent Palestinian Arab journalist and editor-in-chief of Raya Al-Yum, Abdul Bari Atwan, wrote, "The seizure of Iran's oil shipment by U.S. forces constitutes the most heinous form of official piracy and a public declaration of war against Iran." He believes Iran's response to piracy shocked America, as it expected Iran to put up with the blow and not respond. Whereas the Iranian operation to release its stolen oil shipment carried the message that the country's armed forces are not afraid of any military confrontation with the United States, regardless of the price.
Speaking of what happened in the Oman Sea a week before November 4th, the United States has imposed sanctions on other countries besides us, such as Venezuela, Syria, and several other countries. Given that we are being asked to sell oil and oil condensate, we won't be losing on both fronts. We don't accept facing sanctions and at the same time being forced to surrender our uranium and centrifuges, ending our nuclear activities, and not being allowed to trade oil either.
The Islamic Republic has come to understanding that whenever it acts reciprocally in the face of American excessive demands and insists on its own principles, in that regard, it will achieve more success and will somehow be able to get what it wants. Because any time the Islamic Republic has chosen a peaceful policy and made concessions to the U.S., practically nothing has happened, outside its economy being affected and the other side's demands becoming ever so excessive.
What we've got, and with it we can put a dent in the untouchable ghost that was the sole superpower, America. Say the U.S. spy drone Iran captured after downing it in 2019 by its homegrown air defense missile system called Khordad 3 was one of several chances Iran saw to enrich its military manufacture.
We saw what happened during the downing of the Global Hawk drone. The American officials initially announced that the drone has been shot down, so they needed to respond. But soon we saw that the Trump administration officials thought better of it and didn't do anything. The other issue was the airstrike on the Ain al-Assad airbase Iran conducted in retaliation for U.S. assassination of General Soleimani and the Pentagon's subsequent censorship of the fact. The Pentagon tried to hide the fact that 110 of its forces suffered concussions and brain injuries. The reason was that according to the strategies the Pentagon, CENTCOM, and White House have laid out, creating unpredictable tensions with Iran would hurt the U.S. interests.
Talking of competition that will leapfrog to curb a U.S. military power monopoly, the U.S.'s congressionally created National Defense Strategy Commission reports itself that Russia and China possess precision strike capabilities, integrated air defenses, cruise and ballistic missiles, advanced cyber warfare, and anti-satellite capabilities. Also, another congressionally created watchdog group, the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, reports that China has recently introduced a new stealth fighter, the J-20, and that its growing ballistic and cruise missile inventory can target U.S. bases and surface ships, including aircraft carriers. Also, Russia claimed to have successfully tested a shipborne hypersonic missile that travels at roughly 8 times the speed of sound, which the U.S. apparently has no defense against. Among regional countries and beyond, Iran stands out. It has suffered unprecedented U.S. sanctions and pressure, even assassinations of its nuclear scientists by U.S. ally Israel. Yet, it has stood up to imperialism and hegemony and even managed to greatly resist it. Our guest explains how Iran differs.
Well, today, the Islamic Republic of Iran has gained considerable capabilities. The capabilities of the Islamic Republic's armed forces are used as deterrents. Our equipment and facilities aren't dependent on any world power, be it Eastern or Western. Our capabilities originate from the inside. We currently have anti-radar missiles. We also have radars that can detect anti-radar missiles. We have armed parts of our sea so we can respond to any threat against the Islamic Republic.
There is no international trade or political relationship with Iran that is not sanctioned by the United States. U.S. sanctions were reinstated in 2018 after America's withdrawal from the JCPOA, particularly those sanctions imposed on the energy, shipping, and financial sectors in November of that year. This caused foreign investment to dry up and hit Iran's oil exports. But Iran succeeded in continuing its economic life and even flourishing in some areas all the same. And this is the main reason that pulled down the U.S. from sitting on the summit to ask Iran to come to the negotiating table.
In the new world, most countries try to make concessions when it comes to the economy and their domestic governance.
The Islamic Republic of Iran entered the JCPOA negotiations due to the internal demands, but it was faced with the U.S. reneging on its promises. The Islamic Republic has come to the conclusion that any time it has started a process with the U.S., it has been the American side that disrupted and challenged it.
Sanctions and incarceration have encouraged Iran to reinforce its defenses and work on technological advancement in some fields more than others. Say, with Trump's U.S.'s binning of the nuclear deal of 2015 and European parties not managing or wanting to live up to their share of the commitment, Iran revived and unbridled its nuclear program, which it has maintained as peaceful all along, and which it had choked in compliance with the nuclear deal or JCPOA. To mark National Nuclear Technology Day, Iran in April and after the opening week of Vienna talks started feeding gas to cascades of new advanced centrifuges. It also unveiled dozens of achievements to show its nuclear program is peaceful. 133 technological innovations for both medical and civilian use were unveiled. Iran turned to the IR-6 centrifuge, said to be capable of producing 10 times more uranium hexafluoride, UF6, than IR-1. That's Iran's first-generation centrifuge. And it says it can industrialize these machines without any reliance outside the country. Also, mechanical tests began on the top-of-the-line IR-9 centrifuge that has a separative capacity of 50 SWU. Also, a unit to assemble and evaluate advanced centrifuges was launched in Natanz. And the second phase of industrial production of deuterium compounds was launched at the Arak Heavy Water Reactor facility. Iran has been enriching uranium to 60%, and that 60% enriched uranium has mounted to 25 kilograms, Iran recently announced.
Looking at the oil tanker situation and how Iran acted upon it, would you say that this country can act as a role model for other countries? To what extent can it do so?
Well, following the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, we saw that discursive political and ideological branches of Iran's anti-imperialist viewpoint spread across the world, both in the immediate region and other geographical areas, including Latin America. But let's not forget that when these discourses are coupled with hard and military power, we definitely see it grow, or to use a better word, increasingly expand.
Apart from the world catching up, the U.S. has also weakened itself by overreaching in its adventurism and venturing into not properly pre-planned wars. Actually, former President Trump had put Iran next on the possible hit list. From the American Civil War through the Korean War, U.S. conflicts have mostly been paid for by taxes and war bonds. But in the post-September 11 era, U.S. military spending has almost entirely been financed by debt. It took $2.2 trillion to finance the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, according to figures from Brown University's Costs of War project. And that sum, which is roughly 10% of the country's total gross domestic product, GDP, only reflects upfront costs. By including the cost of interest, we'd be adding another $2.1 trillion by 2030. And through 2050, the interest alone should top $6.5 trillion, even if war spending had theoretically stopped in 2019. That's according to research published last year from Heidi Peltier, director of the 20 Years of War project at Boston University's Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future, CBS reports. Never mind the cost of war, there's domestic financial demands U.S. President Biden has to address at home.
That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do join us again at the same times next week and each week after for more on tight spots and how to survive or get out of them, or anything else. Bye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet.
He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam urged the Muslims to feel pity for the orphan and to have affection for the weak. He, peace be upon him, said, "Whoever has four qualities, Allah will build a house for him in paradise. The one who shelters the orphan, has mercy on the weak, feels compassion for his parents, and treats his slave gently."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we're talking about the various conversations that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam had with his companions and his friends and his family members and his relatives. Now, sometimes we think that a conversation or a dialogue needs to be incredibly long, 45 minutes, 1 hour, or more, in order for one to benefit from a conversation or a dialogue. We find that the infallible imams have taught us the opposite. Sometimes a whole world and universe of wisdom can be exchanged in just a matter of a few sentences. One of the famous companions of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam was Zarara. Now Zarara, of course, he was, as I said, one of the most famous and faithful and loyal companions of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. And so in one of these conversations between Imam and disciple, between master and teacher and student, we find that Zurara, he asks Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, "What is the meaning of al-Hanafiyya?" And so it's interesting because in another place we read that Prophet Abraham, was upon the religion, the Hanafi religion. Now, the religion Hanafiya. Now, this isn't the Ahl Sunnah Fiqh jurisprudential Hanafi sect, right? This is Dinul Hanif, the religion of Hanif, the Hanif religion. And so along this context, Zurara asks Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, what is the meaning of al-Hanafiyya? Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam replies, it is the nature that Allah has created in a human being. Allah has created this nature, this fitrah, in human beings so that they will be able to recognize Allah. And so one of the questions, dear friends, that we might ask in our daily lives, or we might have asked, you know, in the past, is what was the religion of the parents of the Holy Prophet Muhammad? Well, this, dear friends, is the answer. They were on this Al-Hanafiyya religion, this Deenul Hanif, this nature that Allah has created in human beings, this nature of Tawheed, of monotheism, of believing in one God, and this Hanafiyya which Allah has created in them to make them recognize Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, besides the specific words of the Prophet that he presented to the Ummah of the Prophet, besides the particular sunan, traditions of the Prophet that he tried to shed light on, the ahkam of Islam that he tried to shed light on, the tafsir of Quran that he tried to shed light on, besides the specifics, there were certain components that he stressed on repeatedly and created this, I want to call it a culture, because it became widespread. Be it that not exactly every aspect or every detail of the approach that he's presenting for people to have was taken on board by everyone, but a movement was created that led the Muslim community overall to leave the conditions they were in towards better conditions. And those principles are this. Look at the Quran itself. Refer to the Quran. We have companions coming to the Imam, ask questions about the ahkam. The Imam could simply just say, this is what the hukm is. The Imam doesn't do that. He said, have you read this verse of the Quran? Or in some instances, this could be understood from this verse of the Quran, that verse of the Quran. Telling people, go back to the Quran itself. What happened to that?
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.